WIOX is supported by Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center on State Route 10 in Walton, open Tuesday through Saturday for disposal and recycling, reminding patrons to keep trips to the center at a minimum due to higher than normal volume. And if possible, store clean recyclables at home until May. Delaware County Solid Waste Management Center hours of operation and information about materials and disposal fees at 607-832-5800. 607-832-5800. WIOX is supported by Margaretville Hospital, a member of the Westchester Medical Center Health Network, a critical access hospital offering comprehensive medical services, including emergency, cardiology, imaging, rehab, and a retail pharmacy. 845-586-1800. WIOX is supported by Roxbury Wines and Spirits, on Main Street in Roxbury. Open every day except Sunday from 12 noon to 6 p.m. for contactless curbside pickup or delivery to your open vehicle trunk or hatchback. Selection of wines listed at RoxburyWinesAndSpirits.com. Orders by phone or email 607-326-6200 or Jeff at RoxburyWinesAndSpirits.com.
Hi, this is Sunny Oaks, host of Folk Music and Other Stuff, alternate Friday afternoons from 2 to 4 on WIOX Roxbury, serving New York's Catskill region at 91.3 FM, WIOXRadio.org, and MTC Cable Channel 20.
Okay, you're listening to WIOX Community Radio, live and local, in the Catskill Mountains at 91.3 FM and MTC Cable Channel 20, and everywhere at WIOXRadio.org, where it's easy to donate if you like what you hear. You can also get WIOX on any smart device through the FM radio apps. This is From the Forest, every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., talk about a different forest-related topic with Ryan and John. John, how's it going?
Things are good. How are you, Ryan?
Yeah, I'm well.
Good.
Can't complain.
What's going on in the forest this week?
What's going on in the forest this week? Well, you know, when we're not here at IOX, for Catskill Forest Association, grafting some apple trees.
Yep.
Yeah.
It's, I don't know, almost three quarters of the way through the season now.
Yeah, I guess we are. Today's what, May 6th, May 5th? What is it? What is today's date? 4th? Yeah. Where am I? Who am I?
Sixth, I think.
Sixth. Yeah.
But yeah, there's about 2 to 3 more weeks left in the busy part of the season.
Yeah.
Maybe a couple stragglers after that, but that's it.
Yeah.
But it's also turkey season.
Turkeys.
Yep, turkey well, season's open since the last time we were on the air.
Did you shoot one in the face, John?
Yes, I got a turkey.
You didn't shoot it in the face?
Yeah, I did. But
okay, why didn't you just say that?
Yes, I shot a turkey in the face.
Yeah, I mean, that's what you got to do, I guess, right?
Yeah, no, that's where you aim. You aim for the head, so.
Yeah, good shot?
Yes.
Turkey went down.
It didn't even flop.
Did you eat the turkey?
About a quarter of it. There's a lot of meals in a turkey for two people.
Oh, yeah, what are you going to do first? Or what did you do first?
Well, Julia cooked turkey tenders.
Turkey tenders?
Yeah, like chicken tenders. Same recipe.
Batter?
Yep.
Eggs?
Yep.
Then what? What kind of breadcrumbs?
I don't know. Probably panko, but I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah?
Then tonight we're doing turkey and venison stir fry.
Holy cow. That sounds good.
So, I'll be rushing home after this radio program.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. My girls, the chickens, have turned up the egg production line. Don't know why. I mean, it's spring, but I thought they would have done it a little sooner. So I'll be having a frittata tonight with ground venison in it.
Wow.
Yeah.
Excellent.
Yeah, no, I like that. And the cast iron skillet, you know, comes out pretty good. You just throw all your leftover vegetables in it too, you know, broccoli, whatnot, stuff that no one else eats. So, yeah.
Good. So we're both having meals from the forest tonight.
That's right. Other than that, I've been scrambling with mulch, so I'm all done now. I mulched all the trees. That's good. And it's a good time of year to mulch. You know, just wood chips. You know, so keep the weeds down.
Good.
And then that's it.
And leaks are up.
Yeah.
Or ramps, other people call them.
Whatever. Ramps, leaks. Yeah. Yeah, they are.
Another week or so, I'll be picking some to pickle.
I saw some down in Accord.
Yeah.
And I think we saw it, and that was at, 200 feet elevation? And then we saw some all the way up there at 2,300 in the head of Denver Vega.
Yep.
So they're out, we can say, for sure.
Everywhere. Yeah, absolutely.
They're that Accord to Denver. Right?
Right. Across two counties and 2,000 feet.
Yeah, and then we had to cut down a tree. It was pretty big and old. About 150 to 175 years old. That takes us back to 1850. That's pre-Civil War stuff.
It was amazing. It was a big chestnut oak. Had to come down.
It had to come down.
Yeah, we didn't cut it just because. But yeah, it was the biggest chestnut oak I think I've ever seen, as at least the crown goes, and the stem. The stem was large, but usually when you see them approaching that size, they're going the other way fast. Their crowns are receding, and they're falling apart. But
yeah, and this one was starting to. The center was starting to hollow out and didn't have much left. But yeah, 1850, you know. And chestnut oak requires a lot of fire, so something was going on even before 1850 to produce such a tree. It had to come from other chestnut oak. So humans have been in that area near Kerhonkson for a long time, burning and, you know, clearing land. But tonight's topic is going to be wild bees, trees, and more, with Cornell University's Cass Urban Mead. She is a PhD candidate in the Danforth and McCart Labs at Cornell University Entomology Department. And she's interested in sustainable land management for insect conservation, agriculture, and forestry. Her dissertation explores the landscape, nutritional network, and community ecology of wild bees and agroecosystems. And she does a lot of tree climbing and temperate tree canopies to research how forest resources are used by orchard pollinating wild bee species. So let me see if I can get her on. Cass, are you there?
Hello. Yes, I can hear you.
All right. Where are you calling from?
Oh, well, I am in Ithaca, New York.
All right, that makes sense.
And it's cold. Yeah. Yeah, you guys made me hungry.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, we're usually hungry by the time this show comes on, so.
Yeah, it sounded delicious. Well, it's been cold and rainy here all day.
No kidding.
Huh. Rain. We didn't have rain here yet, or at least not while we've been here. Ryan and I have been all over the Catskills today.
So I was just introducing you. So you're a PhD candidate at Cornell University, is that right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I've been here about 4 years now in the entomology program.
What got you into bees anyway?
Oh, well, let's see. So I actually grew up in the Hudson Valley, across the river from the Catskills. I grew up in Hyde Park, Strasburg. And we had a bunch of goats in the backyard, and I got really interested in farming generally. And then I guess when I was an undergrad, I was looking around. I was an undergrad in the city, and I was looking around for a way to stay involved with ag, whatnot, the things I felt like I cared about most, actually. And I found a honeybee lab, and I was researching the microbes that live in honeybee guts. And then that professor took a job somewhere else, and I ended up switching into a different lab that just studied grasshoppers, and I started just catching all the bees that were in the meadow where they studied the grasshoppers, and that's when I discovered how many other species of bees there were, and their, like, incredible diversity and how good of pollinators they were. And I never planned to go to grad school, but I got hooked and never looked back.
Yeah, and I mean, a lot of people are familiar, obviously, with the honeybee, but the honeybee is it from North America? It's not, right?
No, it's the European honeybee. So there's 7 species of honeybees in the world, but none of them are native to this part of North America. So the Apis mellifera, the honeybee that we all really know and love, actually came over with the colonists. The date is usually put around 1622, although it's hard to know exactly. I tend to think of the honeybee more in the category of like a beloved livestock. It relies on us to take care of it. It gives us things we love. Our relationship with the honeybee is really important and connects a lot of people to the land and to nature and to important services. But we shouldn't think of it as a wild creature.
So how many species of bees are there in New York State?
Ooh, you want to guess?
Hundreds. I don't know.
More.
Thousands.
Millions.
In between. There's actually 417 species. I'm actually, like, lucky enough these days to be in the lab of the people doing the checklist. So just in the last 2 years, we found another bee that we didn't realize lived in our state boundaries. So there's 417 species. But watch out for Cornell's new checklist. We're doing a big survey, and we might even find more. So there's 417 just in New York. But then in the U.S., we know of about 4,000 species of bees. And then when you zoom out to the whole world, it just adds all the other ecosystems, all the other histories. There's actually 20,000 species of different bees in the world. So when you think honeybees are only 7 of them, kind of like mind-boggling.
So, I mean, you know, Häagen-Dazs, when you flip the cover of a Häagen-Dazs cover, it says on the back, you know, how important honeybees are for pollinating orchards and stuff, and we wouldn't basically eat any food without the honeybee. But what you're telling me is there's other bees out there pollinating stuff, and Häagen-Dazs just being lazy, and they should be listing 416 more bees.
Yeah, pretty much. You know, it's a catchy figure. I see where they're getting at. Our food, you know, but I think the honeybee is getting credit for a lot of work a lot of other bees are doing, too.
Yeah, all right.
There's whole groups of important crops that actually honeybees can't pollinate. So, like, alfalfa has a tripping mechanism where the flower flips back when you go in to pollinate it. And only the alfalfa leaf-cutting bee and a couple other bees have learned how to handle that floral mechanism. It's kind of like the turgor pressure in the flower itself bounces back, and it actually is pretty funny videos if you look on YouTube of honeybees getting hit in the face by the alfalfa flower. And a lot of those stats that Häagen-Dazs and other places you've heard, you know, the 1 in 3 bites is from bees. The alfalfa is calculated in that, since that's what a lot of our meat. The cows need to eat the alfalfa first, so that whole part is misattributed to honeybees. So now you know.
So you hear constantly of save the bees. Mostly people think about honeybees. Is there more to the story than this?
Yeah. I mean, I think that it's really important. And most of the things you'll hear that are action items, well, you know, after someone says, all right, save the bees, and you say, then what? You know, most of the things you'll hear that'll apply to honeybees will also help the wild bees in a lot of ways. So things like planting more floral resources, lots of diversity of flowers blooming all year round, thinking about nesting habitats for bees, which I'm happy to chat about more, multiple habitats on the landscape, minimizing pesticide sprays. A lot of those things will help increase the health of all the insects in your region. But it is a little bit tricky sometimes, just like keeping a hive of honeybees in your backyard helps increase the population of honeybees in that region, but it's not necessarily going to help the wild community of insects unless you also do these other things about habitat and resources.
Now,
am I starting to get where you're going there?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned honeybees as more of a, you know, agricultural, like cows. I mean, people stop liking cows tomorrow, stop liking beef, cows would go away. So I guess that's kind of the way I'm thinking about honeybees right now. And maybe we should shift more of a focus to native pollinators.
Yeah, I think so. I think you know, there's really good reasons we keep cows, really good reasons we keep chickens, really good reasons we keep honeybees. But yeah, it's a much bigger story to think about their conservation. And a lot of them are just so beautiful and have such interesting life histories and life cycles, and they come in all different colors. So I think, like, if somebody's like, oh, but I love my honeybees, and that feels disappointing, like, you can still have your honeybees, you know, but don't be afraid. This whole new world is actually pretty exciting once you learn to see it.
So I'm paying attention to the flowers right now, and right now in my yard, the peach are flowering and the Asian pears are flowering. Both not native from the area, but bumblebees and honeybees I've noticed are both out there pollinating. Not many of them, but more so bumblebees for the most part.
Yeah, right now the bumblebee queens are all out. I'm assuming that would be pretty similar phenology where you guys are. Yeah, so right now it's just the queens you'll see, and they're the really big, bumbling ones. They're out stocking up so that they can found their nest in the spring, which is now. And then as soon as they've found a good place to hunker down and they've got enough resources to start their first eggs, then you'll only see the worker eggs they've laid, and you won't see the queen again. So this is like that really cool time of year to see the queens out.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. with Ryan and John. Tonight's topic is wild bees, trees, and more with Cornell University's Cass Urban-Mead. So let's talk about describing a bee. How does it differ from other lookalikes such as wasps and hornets?
Totally. Yeah, I like to think of bees as fuzzy vegetarian wasps. Just because that... it's oversimplified, but it kind of hones you in on the most important part. So wasps and hornets are cousins of bees. And basically, a long time ago, there were wasps that were feeding on maybe pollen or maybe thrips, those little insects that will live inside flowers. And those ancestors of bees figured out that if they started eating that pollen, they could also rear their brood on the pollen. And so basically that whole line of descendants from those wasps who switched over to eating pollen are the bees. So that's why they sometimes do look similar. Some of it has to do with, you know, other reasons, other pressures in ecology, why insects look alike. But they're basically, they're the pollen-eating cousins of wasps. So we think of bees as pollinating, right? They go flower to flower, they pick up nectar, but what are they actually doing? What they're really doing, besides getting some sugars for their body, is also gathering really unbelievable volumes of pollen that they pack onto their legs or onto their underbellies, wherever their scopa are, depending on the bee. And then they bring that back somewhere to their nest, right? Beekeepers know this well. They're putting them into the comb. But all these wild bees have different types of nests, and they have to pack all that pollen in to create the food resource that their baby bee is going to eat. And so the fuzzy part comes in there. So even though bees look enormously different, huge variation, they'll all have branched hairs. So just like a tree with branches, they have hairs with branches on them that help them hold the pollen onto their body. And so that's the fuzzy part. But usually bees are a little chunkier and a little fuzzier than a wasp. All right, that was probably too long of an answer.
So can you produce honey from other species of bees then?
Mostly no. Most bees do not produce honey. Bumblebees have a kind of honey type thing. There's stingless bees, the meliponians. They're mostly in South and Central America. And they have a really, really incredible honey production. And they're actually, they don't sting. But no, the vast majority of our bees actually don't produce honey. They're just free living, and then they go back and they just make these little pollen mounds. And so that gets on to another really interesting part of their biology is most of them don't live in colonies, but instead will just have one or maybe a couple bees taking care of their offspring. And so because of that, they don't hibernate as a full colony, so they don't have to make honey to feed everybody through the winter.
So honeybees are kind of weird. That's what you're saying.
They are. Yeah. Yes, they're magical, wonderful weirdos.
Yeah, why do they make so much honey? I don't get it. They want to survive the winter, but they're like the most social, is what you're saying, compared to all other bees, wild bees. Or is that not right?
Yeah, there's a couple other bees that have that same level of sociality, but they would usually boom and bust during the growing season, and then they have different ways of surviving the winter. So yeah, the honeybees are pretty cool. I mean, the bumblebees have big social colonies, but they actually all die at the end of the season, except the new queens, who mate before they live through the winter. They hibernate through the winter already mated, so they just have to come out as just their queens, and they can start the whole cycle all by themselves.
Huh.
Which sounds wild. I have to tell you one more piece of biology for that to make sense. I can hear listeners scratching their heads. The reason that is that the sex determination in bees is extremely different than in humans. And bees can choose to lay an egg that will grow up to be either a male or a female bee. So that's how she can choose. She can start an entire colony with just the one queen.
Get out of town.
Yeah.
How do you know that?
Haplodiploidy. It's a mating system. So they fertilize an egg, it becomes a female bee. And if they don't fertilize the egg, it becomes a male bee. And those male bees actually only have genes from the queen. And she won't start making males till the very end of the season when the colony is thriving. And she's like, all right, I think our colony is big and healthy enough. We can start making some new queens for next year, and we can start making some males to mate with other queens. Hmm. And that's the last thing. But all those workers in between, she makes some fertilized eggs that just become worker bees. Bumblebee life cycles are so cool. Stuff you never learn in school. When I started learning this, I was like, why didn't they teach me this?
What other bee is cool to you then? Is there another species you can highlight?
Let's see. Well, I mean, it would be kind of good just to tell you what the solitary bee life cycle is like. So probably folks, especially anybody with apple trees, might have heard of mason bees. These are in the family of leaf cutters, and they're other fuzzy belly bees is what I like to call them. You can tell them apart when they're flying pretty easily because all their pollen hairs are on the underside of their abdomen. So they look like, especially when there's pollen in them, they'll have a giant yellow underbelly. And they're real chunky bees. They're really cute. So the solitary bees, just one female is in charge of all the provisioning. So meaning all the pollen and nectar gathering to create the food for her bees, for her babies that she's preparing. And so a mason bee lives in a tube. If anybody's seen these, they're making a bee hotel maybe. Those are increasingly common at nature centers and other outreach events. You can imagine them going to the back of that tube, making a giant ball of pollen, laying an egg on it. And then if it's a mason bee, they build a little wall of mud and they block off that little cell and then they just leave it. So that egg will hatch. It'll grow into a larvae. It'll eat down that whole pollen ball. And then it'll wait until over the winter. When it finishes the pollen ball, then it pupates, and it'll just hang out all year. And the female bee who set up that nest, she keeps going, and she makes one little room after another all down that little tunnel. And each one has an individual bee. And when it fills up, she moves on, and then eventually she'll die. And a lot of those bees only live a couple weeks, and they have really short life cycles. And then those next overwintering bees, they come out the next spring and do the same thing, without ever forming a big colony, and usually only active a couple weeks.
And they specialize in apples?
They're really good apple pollinators, yeah. They really like herbaceous plants. They love orchard crops. You'll see them on a lot of different flowers, but they're really, really effective orchard pollinators.
Huh. How could you attract those to your orchard then? I know there's a lot of listeners that might have a half a dozen trees or so.
Yeah, you could put out a nest, but which is fine. You want to make sure that you read carefully the instructions for bringing those in the winter and cooling down so that they don't just get... Sometimes people put out those nests that you can order online and you end up just with their parasitoid wasp colonizing the nest, which is fine. You know, there's nothing wrong with supporting that wasp. But I would really think that the most important thing would just be to work on supporting all the other shrubs and flowers and think about nest habitats in your lawn or in the rest of your area. And over time, you'll end up building up the resources to support your other pollinators. So, I mean, my work really focuses on woody shrubs and trees that are really good for bees, but that doesn't undercut the huge importance of all the regular flowers that we're used to thinking of. And the best thing to do is really to work with the local native plant garden and think about flowers of lots of different shapes and sizes, some that bloom early, some that bloom midsummer, and then some that bloom late summer, so that you have support for these bees all year round. Because if you just have, right, this probably isn't your listeners, but, you know, you think of people who are just trying to support their one tree. They're like, why aren't they coming to this tree? If there's nothing for that bee when the tree isn't blooming, they're not going to stick around and be there when your tree blooms. So it's really just about having those resources continuously to keep a vibrant population going.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest. Tonight's topic is Wild Bees, Trees, and More with Cornell University's Cass Urban-Mead. So what is the viability of wild bees? How are they doing overall in New York State?
Well, we hear a lot about insect decline, and bees are not free from that. There's a lot of bees that are doing just fine. There's a couple, like the common eastern bumblebee is thriving. There's a couple of mason bees that seem to be doing pretty well. And honestly, we're not sure exactly what it is about those bumblebees or others that makes them do so well. But we do know that there are lots of rare and declining species, and a lot of those have to do with habitat threatening. So the major driver really is habitat loss. And so sometimes... If you think, okay, there's 20,000 bees, right, coming back to, well, what are they possibly all doing? We've only highlighted a couple of them. Many of those bees are actually highly specialized. And so there's a lot of loss when habitats get really fragmented, if patches are really isolated of where their flower is going to be, or if there isn't a good nesting site nearby anymore. We're pretty worried, and I think that all of the environmental conservation efforts you kind of hear will dovetail with also protecting these wild pollinators.
When you say habitat, what exactly do you mean?
So it really depends exactly on the species, exactly what the habitat is, and that's where it gets tricky. There's not like one universal, you know, it's not like a wetland species where, oh, we need a wetland. But there might be one or two bees. Is actually the native loosestrife has a specialized oil collecting bee who will go just to that lithrum, and so if you're protecting wetlands, you're actually in on the side, you know, those side growing plants, you'll also protect that specialist bee. I was just learning about let's see, what's another good example? So then, you know, I'm really excited about forests. I'm out these days watching a lot of the bees that visit spring ephemerals, as well as looking up into the canopy. And there's a small mining bee. I really love mining bees. They're one of my favorites. They're soil nesters, really, really gentle, sweet spring bees. And there's a trout lily specialist. There's bees we know preferentially visit trillium. The Claytonia, the Originae, the spring mining bee, it's Andrina Originae. So when we think about, okay, keeping the health of our forests alive, that also is going to, by proxy, support a lot of our specialist bees. And there's actually a guide coming out from another person in our lab. Maria Van Dyke is writing a guide for gardeners and backyard planters who want to prioritize supporting these narrow host plant specialists in their gardens, and how to do a good property evaluation, identify which plants you might already have, who you could support, as well as how to get in touch with working with your local native plant community and growers to plant those out into your yard.
Over the last 100 years, you know, we've had a lot of forest regrowth since farm abandonment. Forests are maturing. Age and size classes are increasing. But also, simultaneously, on the forest understory, you have a lot of deer browse of those spring ephemerals, like red trillium, for example, by deer.
Yeah.
How does that impact wild bee populations, do you think?
Well, you know, it's pretty wild. The research on bees in forests has really kind of only begun in the last couple of years, so we can mostly just speculate and assume. But I think that a lot of these trends, like uncontrolled deer browse, loss of spring ephemerals, poor regeneration of some of our beloved forest species, or decline of forest diversity generally, can definitely be linked. We'd assume, we'd hypothesize, right? We need to go out and check it. But I would definitely hypothesize with what I'm hearing from you too. It's just like, well, that can't be good.
I think, John.
Well, I mean, I don't know. You mentioned so many habitat types, but is there like a do-all, end-all that somebody can do, you know, on their property just to benefit the most amount of bees, I guess, is what I'm trying to think of?
I don't know. I don't have like a magic thing besides if we just all kind of try to stop having these perfect pretty lawns and instead think about a greater diversity of flowers, messier yards. So, like, you were asking about the mason bees. So there's, you know, you could buy a box of tubes that are stem nests or tube nests, but what those bees would be nesting in naturally would be beetle burrows, abandoned holes in logs that somebody else created. They would be the canes of last year's raspberries. They would be elderberry canes. There's even some grasses and reeds that now I guess I'm thinking of some of the smaller stem nesting bees, but that those bees would all nest in also. And so those kind of tube-shaped canes and reeds from last year's growth that are now dead and hanging out, sumacs, another big one. I find little, they're called the miniature carpenter bee, not the ones that'll go in and take down your house, but I find them in stems. So, you know, thinking about backyard management, if you don't have a huge property, I definitely want to just think about letting there be leaf piles where bumblebees can overwinter, letting your canes from your raspberries stick around for an extra year and see if anybody goes and nests in them. Think about letting your coarse woody debris kind of just rot where it is, and a lot of those logs and branches will become homes for small wood nesting bees, and lots of other beneficial organisms too.
We're going to take a break, but if you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Tonight's topic is Wild Bees, Trees, and More with Cornell University's Cass Urban-Mead. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m. Talk about a different forest-related topic, and tonight's topic is wild bees, trees, and more with Cornell University's Cass Urban-Mead. And I bet you thought bees were just about honeybees. Apparently, so far, we found out that they were brought in around 1620s, honeybees. They're kind of a weird bee, very social, and stock up on a lot of honey. But apparently, a lot of things pollinate apple trees, like mason bees. I had no idea. But let's talk about forest management, Cass. We're already about almost three-quarters of the way through the show. So, what about forest management, making small openings or cutting techniques and whatnot?
Yeah, absolutely. So I don't want to pretend to be a forester, but I do really love the forest, and I've talked with a lot of people about this, so I'm also, like, pretty excited about feedback. But I guess the most important thing, so what we first knew about bees in forests was, of course, where there are openings and you have shrubby, small plants, you have your rubus, you have your wildflowers opening up in those big gaps, right, exploding in your forest openings. Of course, you see the bees there. And then as the canopy closes, you're going to get a reduction. So there's a lot of research that kind of shows, okay, well, there's more sunlight, there's more bees, super logical. So in that sense, already, we can have an idea that forest management, that's going to increase heterogeneity, that's going to have diversity across the landscape, that's going to really increase diversity of forest patches. Forest management is going to be good for just increasing all those different successional states, and therefore increasing the numbers. So that's one answer, and I think that's true. Right, we kind of see along power line cuts, along old landings, the silviculture, and really a lot of types of cuts. That's great. But then I've also been looking at the forest canopy itself and seeing that a lot of that research, I think, is correct, but is driven by the fact that humans are, you know, however tall we are, 4 to 6-ish feet tall. And so we're going to look and see those patches, those places where bees are about our height. But actually, anybody who has a cherry tree or an apple tree knows that the bees are going to go up, and that actually extends all the way up to our tallest trees. So that's where, like, the tree climbing that I've been doing comes in. That's where canopy trapping, stuff that's been known from tropical forests, but we haven't really thought necessarily transferred to temperate forests. And it really seems that bees are up there collecting pollen, even from wind-pollinated trees. I've seen a lot of bees on oak. There's a lot of records of bees collecting from ash and beech. I think about, you know, shelter wood cuts, and other forest regeneration techniques that are using the forest and the knowledge of when those seeds are going to regen in order to support not letting your forest go to kind of monospecies dominance. And that's because these bees are going to visit all these different species for their pollen, depending on when they're out blooming. All right, let me see if we're even remotely on the same page. I can keep going and keep rambling.
Is there a tree that you've noticed while climbing that might attract a greater diversity of bees than others?
So we know that, you know, our cherry, we know willow is hugely attractive. Some of the more surprising, so we know that there's a ton of species of spring bees that will spend a ton of time on maple. So red maple, we see the cellophane bee. We see lots of different mining bees, bumblebees, queens, and sugar maple, too. I've been actually out climbing, waiting to see if really seems like a lot of the sugar maples really bloomed last year and aren't going to bloom in my woodlots this year. I don't think of them as a masking species, but here we are. And the tricky part, of course, about early spring is, like, a lot of these trees are wind-pollinated because it's not reliable. They're going to have amazing weather, right? That's one of the evolutionary reasons we think that so many species from the early spring in these trees are probably became mostly wind-pollinated because the weather is so variable and it's been so rainy. So this year there haven't been that many good bee days. But there's kind of the obvious ones, right? Like a cherry, like a tulip tree that we see have big showy flowers. And we say, oh, yeah, the bees, the beetles, the flies, they're going to be up there doing that thing. Those are good crops. And I think that what I'm really excited about also is saying, hey, the more diversity you get in there, the more resources you're going to give for them, because they're also picking up pollen from oak. They're also picking up pollen from beech. They're also picking up pollen from ash, even though those aren't insect-pollinated species. And then that opens a whole other kettle of fish, which is that bees don't only go up there for pollen and nectar, but there's a lot of records of bees collecting resins from beech and populus, cottonwood, and horse chestnut, for a variety of things. Honeybees will go up there for resins that they'll turn to propolis. Or the resins are sometimes used by other species, even for self-medication or for packaging, for protecting and insulating the outsides of their little nests. And so those are things that species that we don't even think of as providing resources for bees are actually giving really crucial. This kind of self-medication thing is kind of new, exciting research over the last decade or so, where bees will seek out these different resins and secretions depending on their pest pressure, their pathogen pressure on their guts. So that's really cool.
The bees are taking, harvesting sap and resins, I would assume, from conifers and using them for medication and for their nest building?
Yeah, some conifers. And then even from beech or cottonwood or horse chestnut, there's records.
Wow.
Them kind of collecting these like secretions on the edges.
Okay.
It's pretty cool. So that's why I hesitate to name one favorite tree. You know, there's so many good ones you can plant. I think you can never go wrong if you're not a forester, but you're just a person with a yard. You know, plant fruit trees, plant willows, plant anything rosaceous. But also, like, keep an eye on those, you know, those oak blossoms. Keep an eye on those acer is what I was going to say. Those maple blossoms, because there might be bees there, too.
I mean, yellow poplar comes to mind. Huge flowers. Catalpa, I know it's not as native, but, man,
yeah.
That tree puts out some flowers.
Doesn't it? It's pretty incredible. I know, I would love to sample on a catalpa. That would be so interesting. I'm actually pretty excited to go to a friend's, friend has some pretty incredible chestnuts he's had established. They're looking at 40, 50 years now. There's a couple bees that we think are specialized on chestnut. And we know chestnut is kind of partially wind, partially insect pollinated. And you think about the resources when we kind of lost chestnut forests, how many insects were associated and benefiting from it. I mean, for all the reasons we wish we still had chestnut, but pretty cool stories there. So I'll let you know if I find any other cool bees visiting those blossoms too.
Real quick, as a forester, you know, they taught us you do a cutting in the woods, and if you don't get regeneration, you know, you failed, right? That's what they would teach you in school. But I always tell people, hey, for wildlife, even if we don't get seedlings growing up, at least we have coarse woody debris as cover and habitat. Is that true with bees or not so much?
I really think it's true, I mean, I think of, you know, cuttings for bees in the same sense that you think of, you know, doing ecological forest management for birds, right? You're thinking about multiple layers of diversity, not just, you know, species like across patches, but also within a forest patch. Do you have that downed woody debris? Do you have those shrubs? Do you have that regen? I mean, and we know there's a bunch of different species that will nest just in rotting logs. Some of my favorite shiny green species. There's kind of this interesting ecological pattern where a lot of insects, even beetles and flies, the farther into a forest they live, the more likely they are to be kind of iridescent green. And we think that's like a predator avoidance thing because they're always flitting in and out of the shadows and it confuses predators. Anyway, a lot of the cool bees that will nest even pretty far down in the forest, deep in the forest, will be the ones who are excavating their tunnels inside real punky wood, places you don't think of a bee when you see it. But if you sit there on a sunny day and you kind of watch for a little glints of green, those are actually little pollinating sweat bees who are running out to go find something to collect.
You mentioned mason bees and bumblebees. Is that sweat bees? What are those?
Yeah, sweat bees. That's a whole other group. They're really diverse. In terms of life history strategies, some of them are super social, some of them are solitary. They're the ones, so if you've ever heard somebody talk about a sweat bee, it's probably because it was like there's a little dark bee that landed on your arm and maybe bit you. It felt like that's because they really will come and, you know, just like they're picking up things we don't think of, like mason bees collecting soil, like bees going up to collect resins for self-medication, they're also doing things like landing on our arms and collecting those salts. Now, there's pretty amazing pictures you can Google of, like, bees drinking the tears of turtles to get those salts and nutrients. So those are the sweat bees who would land on your arm.
Only from the saddest of turtles.
Live in the forest, yeah.
So wait a second. Yeah, are you saying someone is studying sweat bees taking the salts out of turtle tears?
Studying it, but there's definitely really enthusiastic people who take pictures of them.
Amazing.
But, you know, if you're the person out there studying it and I overlooked it, I apologize. You know, you never know what people are studying.
All right, so you can't really mention bees without talking about chemicals. John and I are licensed pesticide applicators, and most labels have something to say about bees and when you can and cannot spray. So what do you have to say about chemicals?
Well, we know that insecticides, you know, are out there to kill insects, and bees are insects. We also know that they do really important things in our environment to protect our food, and, you know, we're living in a balance. So I think probably the general recommendations of don't spray things that are blooming, pretty important. I think the main thing that we could add, maybe from what we've, like, thinking about, like, the diversity of all these different life histories, is also to learn to notice other nest sites that you didn't know were bee nests and avoid those areas too. I mean, I can't tell you've never spray over a rotten log, but maybe keep an eye over them. And also there'll be bare patches of ground where the soil nesters will dwell. And these aren't like aggressive ground bees. They're like the little gentle burrowing solitary ground nesting bees. And sometimes you'll learn to spot an aggregation of those soil nesting bees. In terms of bigger trees and treatment, I'm not an expert in this. It's just kind of things I think about as we know, especially the systemic pesticides, insecticides that can, you know, that can really move through the full tissue. We know that those do move into pollens and nectars. So generally, you know, I've looked and I haven't seen any recommendations for thinking about things like you know, HWA or ash, you know, with those treatments, because we don't think of those as bee trees. So there's pretty much no recommendations. And because of the longevity of the systemic insecticide in the tissue, and even, you know, people have done studies that find systemics in pollen and nectar even a year after application. So I think it's better to wait till after bloom, but it is a little bit tricky. And obviously, you know, the pressures of another pest or another pressure might trump that. Definitely knowing that they're going to move into the blossoms, and then, you know your system best, and whether or not there's a way to work around it. I don't know.
The good thing about systemics, we do a lot of systemic treatments, is from what I remember, the labels, you can't spray if there's something flowering or you see a bee. You're not supposed to spray. But usually, it's not a forest-wide treatment. You know, it's usually like one or two trees. You know, it's literally a few trees, so... Yeah, it's never like a forest-wide. I just want to make that clear to people listening. It's never a forest-wide treatment. Not a stand treatment or even a group selection, really. Because you can only spray so many per label, and then you're over the label, they say. You're off label because they limit you on how much chemical you can put down per acre.
So in that sense, I think, you know, you're doing what you have to do to protect the health of the forest, and it's not all of them at once. And remember, like... You know, bees are mobile, so hopefully they'd fly away or pick another resource if it's highly localized, and should be fine.
Yeah.
John?
So where's your research leading you right now? Are you climbing up in the canopies in the coming weeks?
Yeah. Things are a little calmer this spring for obvious reasons. So I'm not doing as full of a field season as I might have. What I'm doing right now, actually, is working on writing. I am doing some climbing. I've been up mostly keeping an eye on sugar maples as, like, a special side project right now. There's not actually a lot of research on the degree to which sugar maples are actually insect versus wind pollinated. Maples are kind of all over the map on that one, species by species, which is cool. So I've been up bagging some flowers, trying to figure out some methods for pollination studies. But I also had a bunch of traps that I've just had up in the canopy for the last 3 years, and a bunch of woodlots adjacent to orchards. I've been kind of interested in bees in the forest, and then as the orchard blooms, are they moving into the orchard? And so I'm looking at all those data right now. I have all these bees in my DNA, and I found over 80 species of bees in these forest woodlots. Can't say for sure that they all were there eating pollen or visiting, but a lot of them, we know, at least were flying through, and I'm going to be doing a bunch of diet analyses on those bees to figure out exactly which pollens they were eating over the next little while. And so that's pretty exciting. I'll have that over the time to see, okay, you know, if there's a bunch of oaks blooming, are they actually eating a lot more of that than we thought, because we weren't usually looking way up in the sky. Anecdotally, I'm sure that they're eating it, but in terms of actually saying which species and how much. So, yeah, I don't know. I'll keep you posted. We're doing some analyses. We don't really know how good for bees a lot of these wind-pollinated pollens are in terms of nutrition, in terms of protein. So lots of directions to go.
What's something you wish people knew about bees, wild bees especially?
I don't know, so many things. I hope I've managed to say some of them. You know what? I think mostly I want to just remind people, because I know this is a really big sticking point, is that they're actually really, really gentle. We talked about how honeybees are the quote-unquote, you know, awesome weirdos because they live in these colonies. The colony lifestyle is also the, like, main thing that makes them aggressive, because they're willing to have one worker go out and potentially get in a fight with a big mammal, right, in order to protect that colony. But if you're a solitary bee, like all these solitary species I described, then you don't have any motivation to go after, you know, a human or a bear or something that you think is nearby you aggressively. You're going to be really gentle and just kind of settle back in. So you don't have to worry about them really attacking you. Really, most of these solitary pollinators are super gentle. Also, male bees cannot sting. So that's another thing. If you learn to identify male versus female bees, which may be a story for another day, then you can always know that if you have a male bee, it can't ever sting you anyway. So those are carpenter bees that probably everybody's got flying around their house right now. If you see one with a big yellow patch right on the front of its face, right below its eyeballs in the front, that one's a male bee. They're the ones acting the most aggressive. But that actually, that one can't sting you. You could grab it right out of the air as a party trick. I mean, make sure you really check your IDs before you do this. And don't blame me, but it is true if you get it right.
That's never a party trick I've ever think of. But
yeah, you know? Now you will. I'm broadening the repertoire here.
Sure. When we're allowed to have parties again.
Well, we're going to miss you.
One of these days.
We're going to miss you this year at the Forest Festival. Forest Festival is going to be canceled this year. I understand you were a speaker, right?
Yeah. I was so honored to be invited. I was looking forward to meeting you and everybody there.
Well, I think if you're still willing, we'd definitely like to have you back for next year. So anyone listening, Cass Urban Mead eventually will hopefully be at the Catskill Forest Festival in 2021.
Wonderful. Yeah, well, I hope everyone stays well, and I really, really hope we can do that and look forward to it.
All right. Well, thanks for coming on. We really appreciate the time.
Oh, it was my pleasure. Thank you so much, and have a wonderful rest of your week.
All right, you too. Thank you.
All righty, take care.
Take care. If you just missed the show, this is From the Forest every Wednesday, 6 to 7 p.m., and that was Cass Urban Mead, Cornell University, talking about wild bees.
Who knew? Over 400 species in New York, and most of them docile, and some of them in the tree canopies.
Yeah, it sounds like we don't know them all, and they're finding new ones all the time. How about that?
Yeah. So.
All right. That's all I got tonight. Next week is, I think we're having a guy come on, talk about the super splitter, which is a mechanical splitter.
Super splitter.
From Massachusetts, yeah.
Cool.
Should be cool. All right. Take care. Have a good night. That's all I got.
Good night, everyone. Were dead and the wine was running low. And the old man came home from the forest. His tears fell on the sidewalk as he stumbled in the street. A dozen faces stopped to stare, but no one stopped to speak. For his castle was a hallway, and the bottle was his friend. And the old man stumbled in from the forest. Up a dark and dingy staircase, the old man made his way. His ragged coat around him as upon his cot he lay. And he wondered how it happened that he'd ended up this way. Getting lost like a fool in the forest. And as he lay there sleeping, a vision did appear. Upon his mantle shining, the face of one so dear, who'd loved him in the springtime of a long-forgotten year, when the wildflowers did bloom in the forest. She touched his grizzled fingers and she called him by his name. And then he heard the joyful sound of children at their games. In an old house on a hillside in some forgotten town, where the river runs down from the forest. Jet soars above the canyon streets, and the con men con, but life goes on, for the city never sleeps.